Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring podcasts on the Blue Wire Network. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System yet, then you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. Wherever you are across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's Unified, U-N-I-F-Y-D, healing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE system.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
Welcome to In the Know, the Bourbon Street Shots podcast. Your hosts are Michael McNamara and me, Ryan Schwan. It's all Pelicans, all the time.
Welcome to the show. The Pelicans finish 2-1 since our last podcast, losing by exactly 2 points to Houston. And Michael, there's only 9 games left in the season. Are you ready for the season to end?
There's not 9 games left. There's 15.
That's right. We get a whole nother series after this, huh?
Yeah. No, I mean,
15. So you're saying that we're going to go 6 games and that's it?
Yeah, we're going to beat Golden State in 6 and then just drop the mic and leave the playoff.
That would be awesome. Yeah, we're done.
Yeah, we did all we needed to do. Yeah, no, but, I mean, you're right. Maybe just 9 games, a handful of home games. You know, I know people have been frustrated by this season, but having Pelicans games is always better than not having Pelicans games. So even if this team frustrates you from time to time, gotta enjoy these last couple of weeks.
Yeah, because it's gonna be a long time, and there's no telling what this team will look like next year. And you know, some of these guys are pretty fun to watch, even if from game to game, you don't even understand what's happening with some of them.
Yeah, although we will start the day after the season ends, we will start the 57th pick tournament on the site, because I have a feeling we're going to have a 96-man bracket to get through all the possibilities there. So we're going to have to start from day one.
Oh, man. I'll have to admit, I don't know too many people who we'll probably end up at the back end of the draft. And you know the weirdest part about what I was reading, I think it was, maybe it wasn't Zach Lowe, it might have been Zach Lowe. They were talking about how they're considering expanding the draft to more rounds. I'm like, one out of the 30 guys in the second round actually stays on a team and contributes in any real way. So we need more rounds of that?
Yeah, because we need it. Because what would wind up happening is you would just draft the rights of like all these foreign guys that are always thrown into trades that you just never heard of, but they're needed because teams have to send a piece to another team as part of the trade rules. So, yeah, you would just have a bunch of guys third round get drafted for their rights and rights only. That's exactly what we need. But you said it, 2-1 week. We both predicted 3-0. It was close. 2-point loss. Rockets. Yeah. come in here. We could. I mean, it would have been really cool. That would have clinched the season series for the Pelicans. Something that they could still do with three of the four teams in the Southwest. It looked good. Beverly was out. Dwight Howard was returning, so you didn't know how that was going to affect them. And honestly, we did a lot of the things that we wanted to do, especially on the defensive end. We kept them off the line. The Rockets didn't hit their threes. Looked good early with Tyreke Evans just looking like a man possessed to start the game. But really, it was Evans and Davis, and they didn't get much help from anybody else. Eric Gordon was an epic no-show. The first time since Basketball Reference has been keeping stats, 1985-1986, that a player had no field goals made, no rebounds, no steals in 42 minutes of gameplay. So, Eric Gordon, you achieved that. So, yeah, it was a frustrating game. What were your major takeaways from it?
Donatas Montiejunas is a god. Like, that man is a post-up genius. Because that's what it felt like, at least, all game long. Like, every hook shot he took, it didn't matter if it was 3 feet or 8 feet, 8 feet, 8 feet, or if he was banking it, that ball went in. And we saw that again then with DeMarcus Cousins in the next game. Like, what is with people just murdering us with lucky-ass hook shots?
It was a tale of two different stories, because Cousins was hitting his jumper, but yeah, Montiejunas, and it was something we actually saw a lot this week. Anthony Davis is still biting on the pump fake a ton, you know, on the perimeter. I mean, we saw some guards do it to him later on in the Minnesota game and the Sacramento game, and Montiejunas was just taking his time and patient with Davis, and he did look fairly spectacular. I don't think they win that game without a big night from Montiejunas, because, I mean, really it was just him, Harden, and Ariza that contributed for about, 70% of their points. So, yeah, it was frustrating. But what about on the other end? I mean, where do you think it went wrong? And, I mean, Houston does have a good defense this year, but the Pelicans seem to start off so well, and I mean, 34 points in the first quarter, then they go 18-18-23 the rest of the way. What did you think the major failings on the offensive end were?
Primarily, so in the first quarter, there was a lot of turnovers and the Pelicans running. And you don't get to see the Pelicans run off of turnovers very often, and the Rockets are the worst team in the league at keeping the ball, so they turn the ball over a lot. And that first quarter, the Pelicans were taking advantage of it and running it down their throat, and they were doing a really good job. But once those turnovers dried up and they weren't able to get in transition, the Rockets were really stunningly good at stopping Tyreke Evans from getting to the middle of the floor. And I don't know how many times we saw him try to do a pick and roll, get turned back or pushed way off to the side, and then he just had to pass the ball to somebody else on the perimeter. Unfortunately, usually someone like Dante Cunningham, so they could try to bail him out some way. I mean, Quincy Pondexter had to do a lot more in this game than I'm used to him seeing him have to do, because he kept having to be the release valve, and he's not a fantastic dribble drive penetration guy. So having him be the release valve in this situation, because Gordon couldn't get anything going, it was not an ideal situation. And like Tyreke, you look at his line and you're like, yeah, he must have dominated with 28 points and 16 shots and 7 assists. But there is a stretch through the entire middle of that game until the fourth quarter where he really could not get his penetration going at all. And he was relying on a jumper that was not failing him for once.
Yeah, I mean, he started off with 14 in the first quarter, was hitting his threes. But, I mean, the frustrating one here was obviously Eric Gordon, 0 of 5 from the field, 0 of 3 from 3. I feel like it was, you know, it was fairly simple, Houston's game plan with him. They just put some length on him, and it seemed like he had really a hard time seeing over the length, making passes. I mean, when he runs that pick and roll with Davis, Davis is always open, but smart teams will blitz Eric Gordon or sometimes even trap him, and he can't see over guys. I mean, to me, sometimes it feels like he's smaller than even most point guards. He just seems so small out there, you know, in a sea of other perimeter players, and it felt like he struggled. Anytime he got a kick-out pass, Houston did what any smart team should do, just ran out on him, made him put the ball on the floor, and honestly, when you do that with Eric Gordon, he's pretty much rendered ineffective. Luckily, he got to the line a couple times, but don't you think that, especially if the Pelicans got into a playoff series, that a smart team would watch a couple of tapes of who Eric Gordon has become and shut him down pretty easily?
Yeah, you could do that as long as there isn't another perimeter guy that can help out, like help make Eric Gordon even more of a shooter than he is. I mean, if we had our healthy team, I have a feeling that Eric Gordon would be, you could still probably try to defend him the same way, but the spacing would be a lot better. He would still be able to get into the middle of the defense and maybe hit a layup here and there that would help him out overall. But you're right. Eric Gordon has become Steve Kerr.
Yeah, I mean, he's a solid spot-up shooter. He doesn't give you much defense. I would say he has some playmaking, especially in the second units. I still like the pick-and-roll he runs with Ajinsa, just because Ajinsa is such a big target, he could usually get it to him near the basket. But, yeah, I mean, the only other thing really from this game, obviously the big story coming out, Pelicans lose by two. Anthony Davis misses 8 free throws, including one late, that could have pulled them within one. He goes and stays afterwards till he makes 100. What did you feel about that? I mean, everything from Anthony Davis putting the blame on himself to him going out and working on it. When you heard that story, what were your first thoughts?
I'm kind of cynical about these sorts of things. So I like that Anthony Davis is taking responsibility for missing those free throws and going and working on it. Do I think that him staying after and making sure he hits 100 of them is going to have any impact whatsoever on his ability to hit them in the future? I don't really think so, because he's actually naturally a good free throw shooter. This is one of those fluke nights where sometimes he just misses. And I mean, there were so many other people struggling so mightily in this game that blaming Anthony Davis for that loss is just kind of stupid. There wasn't enough. Norris Cole could not hit it was one of his nights where he wasn't hitting anything. And like I said, like, number one thing, they didn't get any penetration from their guards. And I thought the Rockets were doing a really good job that even if we did manage to get the ball into the mid area for a post up, they would immediately go after whoever had the ball and make them kick it back out to the perimeter, where once again, the Pelicans were being ineffective. And you got to remember, the Rockets are, you know, a top five defense in this league. And I guess this shouldn't be that surprising that the Pelicans had a lot of trouble getting the ball into the paint on them.
Yeah. Normally I would agree, but I mean, they were without Patrick Beverley of 78-year-old Jason Terry. That's why, you know, people were talking about Dwight coming back, but I thought Beverley not being there for Houston was a much, you know, bigger game changer, especially with Dwight only playing 16 minutes. I mean, you had Pablo Prigioni and Jason Terry playing the point this game. I guess I figured that they're,
yeah, but they are able to hide those guys on us. Like, that's the whole thing about us not having Drew or having, you know, Eric Gordon be so ineffective. Like, you can put Pablo Prigioni and Eric Gordon or even Quincy Pondexter and not have to like worry that the world's going to fall on you. So they still have Corey Brewer. They still have Trevor Ariza. Both those guys are pretty good defensive players, and they were sticking to whoever was our primary ball handler at any time. Those guys got that job, and they did a pretty good job on us.
Yeah, the other thing here is we see with these being quasi must-win games, Monty looks like he's, I mean, first of all, he's short in the rotation in this game. And secondly, Anthony Davis got over 44 minutes in this game. As we head down the stretch, assuming that, you know, Davis is healthy, you know, are you expecting his minutes to go way up and him being over 40 as the Pelicans are still in the playoff picture?
Yes. Yeah, I would be shocked if he ever plays less than 40 minutes in any of these games. And I mean, just flat out, like, he doesn't foul enough that he's ever really going to be in foul trouble. So I fully expect that we will see nothing less than 40 minutes in every game from here to the end, unless we fail early and there's no way they're going to make it, like, with like 5 games to go.
Yeah, I mean, what it looks like Monty's doing is he plays them the whole first quarter, then actually plays them the first 3 minutes or so of the second quarter with a lot of the backup guys. Then he pulls him for about 3 or 4 minutes and puts him back in at the end of the quarter. And, you know, he'll do that, or, you know, maybe even shorten that time where he takes Davis out in the second half. So, yeah, he could get anywhere between 40 and 44 minutes. And he's on the court with, you know, guys like Cole while Tyreek's getting a breath. So it'll be interesting to see, especially, and I know we'll talk about it later, with some guys possibly coming back. But, yeah, I think from here on out, you know, 40 to 44 minutes is what you could expect with Davis. And honestly, with that guy on the court almost every minute, you know, the Pelicans could beat almost anybody because his on-off splits have continued to be tremendous. So, yeah, that's all about all I got from this game. Anything else?
I do have one thing. What did you think of McHale calling to have them foul with 2 seconds left when they're up 3?
Well, I mean, I think this is the interesting thing is I think the instruction was if they catch it with the back to the basket. And I think, you know, almost any coach would do that in that amount of time. So it becomes a question of, you know, would it have behooved Monty Davis. I'm just putting him and AD together. But maybe to draw up some kind of play that they wouldn't have been able to do that, or, you know, was it a mistake of Eric Gordon to, you know, kind of take a dribble after he catches that ball? Should he have just turned and squared and shot the 3 because they couldn't have fouled him? So, yeah, I think, you know, smart players and a smart coach would instruct the guys to do that every time. But, you know, if you draw up a player, if the player squares up to the basket, you aren't able to take that foul. So I give Houston a little bit of credit for being aware, but more than anything, you know, our coach or our player have to kind of be blamed for not getting the ball in a position where you could just go up with the shot.
Yeah, it was kind of embarrassing that he took a dribble. I don't. Like, if you have, I think it was like, what, like 2.8 seconds or somewhere around there?
Yeah.
Like, what, just catch and shoot. Like, even if they're in your face, like, taking a dribble towards another defender is not going to clear you space.
And at that point, Gordon's 0 for 5, 0 for 3 from the line. Is he definitely the guy that you would have drawn the play up for?
Oh, it didn't look like that. I didn't think he was the primary guy. There was a fade on the far side that they cut off really well. Mm-hmm. And I think he was the second option. So,
is it crazy that I wanted AD to get the ball there?
A little bit. A little bit crazy. I mean, he obviously has a great history of hitting all of his walk-off 3 attempts.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you can't really count on him to hit that shot because
I mean, Gordon wasn't hitting. Cole was terrible that night. You obviously don't have Drew or...
I should have been going for Tyreek Evans then.
He's
4-6.
Maybe. I mean, but I still, to me, you know, I know he is a big man, but I still kind of like that playoff, you know, hopes are on the line or, you know, it's getting there. There's part of me that just goes with the old kind of school thinking of get the ball to your best player. And I don't know. I would have been able to live with an Anthony Davis miss, especially after you saw how terrible he felt after those free throws. But then again, he might have gone and practiced 103 pointers after the game if he would have missed it. So, it was a game that I think the Pelicans should have won. It was looking really grim after that game. I think, you know, I pretty much saw a large majority of people throwing the towel on the playoff hopes, but the easy part of the schedule was coming up, and, you know, Pelicans obviously went on to win their next game against Sacramento.
Yep. And essentially the Pelicans of the last nine games of the season, they just have to win two more games than Oklahoma City does with their last, what, I guess they're at last eight games of the season. It's not easy. It's not impossible.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure we'll talk about it, but I've got 8-1 gets them into the playoffs. 7-2, I'd say it's a 50-50 shot.
Really? You think OKC's gonna play that well, huh?
I mean, I think OKC basically wins their home games, and then if they get a couple more dogs laid down to them like freaking Suns did last night, I think, I mean, what, Phoenix would have to go, or OKC, if we go 7-2, OKC would have to go 5-3?
Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely think. So, yeah, but I think the goal should be 8-1, or obviously 9-0, you try to win them all, but that's just one game at a time. The Sacramento game was the one you had to get, start off, on a good foot, and it's crazy because, you know, I always do my players of the game either in my head or on Twitter, and I honestly had Omer Asik as my player of the game after this game, and DeMarcus Cousins put up 39-20. So go ahead and tell me how crazy I am that Omer Asik was my player of the game.
Are you serious? Because I think I put it in my recap, but about a three quarters of the way through the game, I was thinking kind of the same thing. Like, I felt like Asik had been battling him really well. He made nothing easy on Cousins at all. Cousins was clearly like not used to having somebody who can at least partially match him physically. And I was like, oh yeah, so Asik's played pretty well. It was somewhere in the third quarter, and then they showed Cousins' stats. At that point, he had 30 and like 16, and I was like, all right, how is that possible? Like, there's no way you can actually say someone did a good job on somebody with those kind of stats. So, sorry, I mean, 39-20, Asik had 12 rebounds. I guess you could point to that, but he still got absolutely demolished by Cousins.
See, demolished stat-wise, but, I mean, watching that game, it was so remarkable to me to see DeMarcus Cousins just refusing to go anywhere near the paint when Asik was on him. And then the second Monty put Ajinsa in the game, there Cousins was playing bully ball, backing him down, shooting baby hooks or getting to the line, which...
Yeah, a lot of those baby hooks were garbage, too, that he was hitting.
But, I mean, you want to talk about I mean, he was hitting contested 20-footers, and Asik would just, you know, shrug his shoulders, like, what are you going to do? But all those shots that Cousins was hitting, you know, I still think that those are low-percentage shots. I still think he makes them, you know, 35 to 40% of the time, and I was happy he was taking them, and he wasn't. You know, I looked up at halftime, and I think Asik had one foul and AD had one foul. So, you know, they weren't getting into foul trouble. Cousins was on the perimeter, and yeah, he was hitting, but Sacramento wasn't getting in the bonus because Cousins was getting fouled. Our big guys weren't getting in foul trouble, and Cousins was just, you know, Asik was really frustrating Cousins, and you saw by the end of the game he was tired, and he was just, you know, kind of throwing his hands up, frustrated by everything. I don't know, like, props to Cousins. He obviously had a tremendous game stat-wise, but I'm so much more afraid of him when he's living in the post and at the free throw line and getting, you know, his team into the bonus. And he just didn't do that in the game. We didn't have to double him. So guys like McLemore weren't open, you know, draining threes on us.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, I just, I thought Ashiq did the best job anybody's ever done in holding a guy to 39 points and 20 rebounds since Bill Russell back in his Wilt Chamberlain days. So, yeah, I mean, I loved him in this game. My runner-up was Quincy Pondexter, who, you know, I thought gave great energy, obviously hit his shot. So,
you know what my actual comparison at the end of that game was, at least in the back of my mind? I felt like I had just watched the, I guess it was 1999, maybe it was 2000, Lakers versus Trailblazers Western Conference Finals, when Arvydas Sabonis was going up against Shaq, and Shaq just absolutely dominated that series points-wise and rebounds-wise, but it felt like when Sabonis was out there, at least he was controlling the damage. And Sabonis could only play like 20 minutes a game in that series because he was 87 years old at that point. It just felt like kind of the same sort of thing. Like when he was out there, at least he made this unbelievably dominant physical person maybe take shots he wouldn't normally try to take.
Yeah, I think you play that game over and Cousins takes the same shots he does against Ashiq, and we're talking about, you know, a far less efficient game. Let me ask you this last thing about Cousins. George Karl, you never know what he's going to do, what kind of roster he wants to put together. DeMarcus Cousins is on the trade block. What is the best package you put together for him this summer if you have a chance of getting him?
Using Pelican resources.
Sure. I mean, you could send guys out to other places, so like Sacramento. Well, I don't know, maybe Carl would, but Sacramento probably wouldn't want Tyreek back. But I'm just saying, you can figure out all the mechanisms of a three-team trade or whatever. But like, what is the most you would give up to bring Cousins in?
Ryan Anderson and one of our two good guards.
And then obviously not re-signing at Ashiq, which is another kind of loss.
Correct.
Okay.
I mean, and yeah, I would do that. I mean, can you, like, Davis and Cousins together, nobody would ever be able to stop the interior scoring of this team.
Yeah.
Although Cousins, like, God, he's such a, he can be so, I watch those clips of him where he just stands there and watches and doesn't move, and you're just kind of like, I can't believe that would actually change. Like, I can't believe that somebody would. I could see people getting sour on a team that's so that's like as terrible as Sacramento Kings, and maybe not be trying quite as hard. But Cousins not hard is insolent, like the level he gets to. It's to the point where it's just like, I cannot believe you have the balls to act that way while you're playing professional basketball. Like that, the way he acts completely turns every single person who's watching him off, including every teammate. You know, it's just a big middle finger to your teammate when you basically take a defensive possession and you stand on the wrong side from the guy you're supposed to be guarding from the basket so he can run and get a clear alley-oop. I don't know if anyone saw that. It was a game against Golden State. And he just basically stood there and let Maurice Spates run to the basket, catch an alley-oop, and dunk it, and he didn't move. He just sat there with his hands on his knees.
Yeah, it looked like one of those things where, like, you ever see on SportsCenter, they have the My Wish, like, little SportsCenter features where they let the 8-year-old kid run for a touchdown.
Yeah.
Yeah, it kind of looked like that. Yeah, it's interesting, and it's, I guess the hard part for me to think about is, I'll put you on the spot. I have no clue what the answer to this is. What do you think's the last 4-5 power forward center combo where both of the guys average like 22 to 25 per game?
Mm-hmm.
You even think of one?
No, not that high.
Yeah, I don't even know.
I could think of a cup like Gasol. Randolph were probably at their best like a 16-20.
Right, yeah. No, I mean, they are moderate usage guys. But, like, I don't even know how that would work. I can't think of – I mean, I'm trying to think of – the easiest thing to do, I guess, is to think of the high-scoring centers because there's so few of them. And then
Shaq and Horace Grant? How much did Horace Grant when he went to Orlando?
Yeah, I do not think that that's – so, I mean, it's just – it's really great to, you know, to pontificate about, you know, this great front line of Davis and Cousins. I don't even know how that would work, and especially in today's NBA that's become such a guard game, it might be the most brilliant, you know, zig when everybody else zags move, but, I mean, it just, you just don't see two big men like that, you know, that talented on the same team, so I it's hard for me to even imagine how it would work, but, yeah, if the opportunity arises, I think, of course, you'd have to consider it, but, yeah, it's really hard for me to picture, you know, what that offense would even look like because I can't think of the last, you know, power forward center combination that was, you know, the two highest usage, highest scoring guys on the team. I mean, you'd probably have to go Duncan Robinson that first year. I think they were probably both around 22. Before Robinson started to decline.
I think even Robinson was a little lower than that when they first joined up. So, yeah, I'm really struggling here. I'm, like, trying to think, like, the Denver Nuggets that had Vandeweghe, or however you say his name.
Vandeweghe, come on, man.
And and English, I guess they're not, well, neither of them were really a center, though they played them as the two big men a lot.
Yeah.
Parrish and McHale.
No, but Parrish was never a high scorer, and obviously you had Bird. So, yeah.
I mean, now, Parrish scored like 19 a game 1 year.
Well, but I'm saying they weren't the two high usage, they weren't
that's
the
true.
Center point. So, yeah, I mean, you would have to go back to, surprisingly, Robinson actually led the team in scoring. That first Duncan year, Robinson scored 21.6 and Duncan scored 21.1. And, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, they were by far the next highest scoring guy was everybody's favorite head coaching prospect, Avery Johnson at 10.2. So, I mean, they were definitely, I mean, that's kind of the blueprint, but you had, you know, you also had two very elite defensive guys and that's how that team won because they only put up 92 points per game. But, yeah, it's just – it's really interesting to think about, but it's hard for me to wrap my mind around how that would work. But not something we have to, I guess, think about too much. I still see it as a limited possibility. I'll ambush you right here. Since the All-Star break, the Pelican with the most – averaging the most points per shot is who?
Since the All-Star break. I'm going to go shooter and say Quincy Pondexter.
You are correct. Yeah.
Yeah.
Would you say that not our second best, but would you say Quincy Pondexter has been our second most consistent offensive player over the last couple months?
No.
Who's more consistent than him?
So Pondexter will still have games where it only takes like 3 or 4 shots. So I can't consider that particularly consistent. I would say Tyreke Evans is I would consider more likely consistent. You still see some variations in him, but you won't have games from him that are 24 points followed by a game where it's 6 points. You're more likely to have more like 13 and 14 and then a couple 25-point outbursts.
Mm.
I guess we did just see a game with 9, but he didn't play the fourth quarter. So
yeah, no, I think Tyreke is the ultimate boom or bust guy. I mean, I don't know. The Golden State game he barely played, but yeah, I mean, he'll give you double digits on most nights. It's just the shooting percentage that I guess I'm thinking more of. I mean, you look at it and he goes, I mean, he had a stretch where he had a bunch of 30% games. Then he has 60% against Miami. Back down to 38% against Boz. It's just, yeah, I guess he'll always give you the production. I just, you know, you don't know if he's going to go 8 for 15 or if he's going to go 3 for 15 on a given night. Where Quincy, yeah, I guess he's taken less shots, but it seems like he seems, you know, to be hitting at least fairly consistency, and he doesn't need to do as much as Tyreek, but I just think it's been, you know, a really great pickup for Dell. I would say that's is a bit of an understatement, but I mean,
let's put it this way though. Like, this is the funny thing about stats. I would bet be willing to bet you that should almost anybody write about Dell Demps' trades this season, which they probably won't because it's much more fun to talk about how much of a schmuck Monty Williams is. They would probably do something like Quincy Prondexter was a failure as a get because they traded Austin Rivers, who was a PER of about 10, for Quincy Prondexter, who's about a PER of 10. So, you know, took one of the worst players in the league and traded him for one of the worst players in the league. But, and, you know, if you just look at his PER for the season, that might be true. But if you look at his pre-All-Star games, so essentially the games he wasn't with the Pelicans, he averaged 5.5 points per game on 37% shooting and 27% from three. Since the All-Star game, he's shooting 48%, 45% from three, and getting 10 points per game and three rebounds and assists and a half. And I would take that any day for like our really our backup small forward is what his role should be.
So, I mean, that's what I was going to ask you. Has he still hasn't done enough for you to be fine with him being the starter going into next season, not looking for an upgrade?
No, I'm definitely looking for an upgrade. I mean, I just don't see any reason why that has to exclude him returning.
No, I mean, returning as a starter, but I mean, what do you need or want in an upgrade?
Better defense. Like, Pondexter's fine defensively, but I don't think that he's great. And I think we have to have a wing stopper. And I'm 100% convinced Eric Gordon is going to remain a Pelican now at this point. Like, I can't see him being, if he had continued his fairly hot play for whatever 1 month of, you know, games we got out of him, so that, you know, at the end of the season, he could point to it and say, after I came back from my labor, I was scoring 15 points a game on excellent shooting, then, you know, maybe I could see him opting out and hoping for a long-term contract. But he's back to crappy Eric Gordon that we know and love for stretches at a time. He's not opting out. And Gordon is a bad defender at this point. You got to have a guy who's really superior if you're going to be hoping for any perimeter improvement, or you just got to be willing to say, Eric Gordon, you're off the bench and we're only going to play you 18 minutes a game or 20 minutes a game.
So would you be willing to sacrifice shooting then for an upgrade in defense? Because to be honest, if all this team has is the mid-level exception, you are not getting a guy who is a better defender than Quincy Pondexter and a similar shooter production-wise. So would you be willing to sacrifice shooting and even, you know, possibly by a decent percentage in order to go get a guy who's a better defender to start over Pondexter?
Yes. And just so I can match that person with Gordon when he's on the team. And, I mean, I would be perfectly fine with us going out and getting a small forward who's going to play 28 minutes to Pondexter's 20 or even 24-24. And having that be our big acquisition is a guy who can just come in and shut people down for a little while on the perimeter. Like, you remember when we talked about our like fantasy trades, like the guy I kept looking at was Michael Kidd-Gilchrist. That guy has no offensive game to speak of, but he is ferocious defensively as a wing defender. And that's what I want a ferocious wing defender if we can find one.
Yeah, I mean, I think the only guy in the price range that possibly comes close to fitting the bill is Jay Crowder, who's shooting 30% from three this year, you know, and is a definite downgrade on the offensive end from what Pondexter's been producing. So, I mean, yeah, ideally I'd love to go get Damari Carroll and move Pondexter to the bench. I just don't know if all the Pelicans have to play with is the MLE. If you're going to find a guy who's definitely going to give you more than Pondexter, especially, I mean, the post All-Star break Quincy Pondexter on the open market makes more than the MLE. I mean, a guy with numbers like, I mean, a 638 true shooting percentage is insane.
Yeah, but we don't have to worry about that. He's under contract.
Yeah, no, I'm just saying, of course I would love a small forward upgrade who's better defensively than Pondexter, but when you get into reality check time, I don't know if that's much of a possibility. So
I have to say, though, I'm really shocked that we went on such a tangent in the middle of this conversation about games that we were watching, because I don't know about you, that Minnesota game was the most exciting game of the season.
In what way?
I was hoping you might come up with something and be like, yeah, it was great. Because it was horrible. Like, I think I might have fallen asleep a couple times during the game.
Yeah, I mean, Wiggins dunks could keep you awake. That guy was, you know, he was kind of fun to watch. Watching Zach LaVine do his imitation of rookie Kobe Bryant against Utah was fun, too. If anybody remembers when Kobe was just pulling up and taking ridiculous threes and airballing them against Utah in the playoff series his rookie year, Zach LaVine just had, like, the ultimate green light and thought he was much better than he was. But, yeah, that game was it was one of those games you always knew the Pelicans would win, but you just kept watching frustrated because they couldn't quite put it away until the fourth quarter.
Yeah, honestly, I didn't even feel like that. Even like they got the lead, and then the Wolves, you know, edged their way back in, and were right with us in the middle of the second. I wasn't worried even for a minute of that game. Like, I just kind of was like, those guys cannot dribble the ball for more than 20 seconds without throwing it out of bounds. It was, I think they ended up with 20 something turnovers, I think, in the game. I mean, it was ridiculous how bad they were at knowing what each other are going to do on the floor. But then I guess they have all the reasons in the world, because their entire team is injured or not playing. And some of these guys haven't been playing for, like, Robbie Hummel, you know, had been out since January, and what's his name? Bennett had been out since February. I got to say, Bennett, take Josh Smith at his worst. Anthony Bennett reminded me of a poor man's version of crappy Josh Smith.
He was terrible. And the more I watch him, I think Cleveland was crazy brilliant. They take him first overall just so they could stink again the next year and then get Wiggins, which lands them low. Yeah, I mean, that, how Anthony Bennett was the first pick. And then, you know, even if you listen to the insiders, the three guys that Philadelphia told us, if they're on the board, we'll make the Drew trade, were Oladipo, who's doing great, Nerlens Noel starting to put up numbers now that he's healthy, and Anthony Bennett was the other one. How did Philadelphia have those three guys as the apple of their eye? One of those things is not like the other, and Anthony Bennett is, I mean, would you be shocked if he was out of the league within 2 to 3 years?
No, I wouldn't be shocked if nobody picked up his next contract. Like, I wouldn't be, like, he's under 2 years. I wouldn't be shocked at all if his contract isn't picked up for next year.
Yeah, I mean, but eventually a number one overall pick, somebody else will give him a some kind of small deal to give him a chance. But yeah, I could see him being out in 2 years. What about Justin Hamilton, the guy that, I mean, the guys that we just give away come back and play with their hair on fire, 11 points on six shots, gets four offensive rebounds. Even at a nice block, you said the Justin Hamilton era only lasted one practice.
No, I mean, come on. I mean, is that guy really any different than Lance Thomas? I mean, he might be a little bit taller, but Lance Thomas could have a game like this every so often too, where you're like, wow, he had it really going. And then the next game he's putting up, you know, the Dante Cunningham, which is two rebounds, an assist, and a couple fouls.
I'm proud of you for going cross-ethnicity comparison there. You could have easily went Lou Amundson. You went Lance Thomas, and, you know, you don't see colors. That's why I like being on the podcast with you.
I'll be honest. I was thinking Jackson Vroman, but I didn't think anybody would remember that guy.
Are you kidding me? He's no Boston Nachbar.
No, nobody was a – Boston Nachbar, I remember writing an article about where I said he was going to be, you know, a wing for the Hornets for probably the next 4 years. That he was awesome.
Yeah, that's why you got suspended from the site for 3 months. it's really hard in games like this. Like, I don't like to be a Debbie Downer. The Pelicans won. Like, you're supposed to be all happy. But I watch games like this, and I look at the brutal stretch that's coming up over the last 7 games, and I just say that if this team really wants to make the playoffs and they play like this, they have absolutely no shot. I mean, the numbers look good after the fourth quarter, and obviously it was a big margin. But this game was still kind of in doubt after three quarters. And I like you said, Minnesota was absolutely terrible. Pelicans didn't really separate themselves until the end. I can't look at this game and get really excited about, you know, the prospects of playing Houston and San Antonio and Golden State and Portland and must-win games and think the team that I saw on that night would have any shot against those guys.
Well, see, that's why we just have to pin all our hopes on the wonderful injury news we've been hearing recently. So go ahead, Michael. Tell us what's happening on the injury front with our boy Drew Holiday and his partner Ryan Anderson.
Well,
they're playing 2-on-2 together. I mean,
yeah,
they're a couple
dominating.
Yeah,
this isn't where you know, Monty's taking them in the low post and spinning on them like he does Robin Lopez.
God, I remember that, and I just remember watching that particular. It was called Real Training Camp, I think.
Yeah.
And I saw Monty just spin and score on him, and I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. Like, that's the guy we went and got.
Oh, Sideshow Bob. But, yeah.
And people still talk about him, saying, like, he is the defensive anchor of Portland and how he's an amazing defensive player. And
yeah, I'm really...
Do you remember him? Like, I remember him being god-awful in the pick and roll.
Oh, on defense?
Yeah.
Oh, he was the worst. Like, I mean, there's no, and what was funny was that he was ranked like 7th on Synergy pick and roll. That's when I stopped using Synergy for my defensive stats, when it told me that Robin Lopez was the 7th best pick and roll defender in the NBA. I never looked at Synergy again for defense, except for, you know, maybe isolation. But no, I mean, Ryan Anderson, so. Looks like he hopes to play on the road trip. And again, this road trip goes Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday. You know, he's just starting to practice. It looks like he's going to give it a go tomorrow as far as trying to run full court, seeing how that goes. He says his knee feels a lot better. So, you know, I'm thinking, if I had to guess, I would guess Friday at Sacramento, back in his hometown. You know, Cousins might not be playing, so he won't have to bang around with him. I think that seems like a logical spot. And Drew Holiday, Monty said today that, you know, a couple of weeks ago they had almost given up hope, but lately it's really been responding. Drew's, you know, one of his main doctors is out in LA. The Pelicans just happen to be playing the Lakers on Wednesday, so he'll get checked up with him, hopefully get a thumbs up. And I think it might be a little longer for him. Joel Meyer said he's going to try to play on the road trip, or he would like to play. But I think maybe circle that date of the 7th when the Warriors come to New Orleans and play, you know, as a possibility. But it seems like the hope and the belief as of right now is that Drew Holiday will play before the season ends, which, you know, honestly shocks me. I had penciled him in my head as just being a guy that I wrote off, and he was going to be shut down for the season. But it looks like, playoffs or no, that the Pelicans are determined to get him on the court, and it looks like he'll be there. So there's something to be excited about.
So you actually wrote a piece about it. I'll let you tell people what you think. But Drew Holiday coming back for, let's say you're right and he comes back on April 7th versus Golden State at home, and he ends up playing the rest of the season. A, are you worried that he's going to come back and be rusty and cost us a game that we have to have? And C, are you worried, like, is it worth bringing him back? Because he may just re-injure himself, and then once again, like, you go into off-season and you have an unhealthy Drew Holiday, and you have to deal with that in your plans.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm going in with the assumption that there is no way that he would be put on the court if he is more susceptible than anybody else to getting that part of his body injured. You know, at some point, you got to play a guy. You can't just always be cautious and shut them down and think that that's the answer. Guys could get injured. But, you know, no, I wouldn't be worried about that. What I would be worried about is him going into the offseason not having played a game since January and him not knowing whether his body could handle it. I think it would be great for him to play 5, 6, 7, 8 games at the end of the season, see, you know, that his body could respond, be able to talk to his doctors about, hey, look, I played 30 minutes in a real NBA game up and down the court. I didn't really feel anything. You know, let's look at some tests and stuff. Yeah, it seems to be doing fine. You know, and have that kind of data to look at and think about over the summer as he continues to train and strengthen all those areas. So, no, I mean, it just seems to be this, you know, this idea that really frustrates me of, you know, when people say that a game doesn't matter or next season is more important. I mean, I agree. When it's something like Kevin Durant, where it was hurting him, of course, get the surgery and shut him down. But if Drew Holiday is feeling good and the doctors clear him, I don't care if there's 30 games left and you're going for the 2 seed or if there's 5 games left and you're out of the playoffs. Like, to me, they play, and they play to build the continuity and, you know, to get their body back into shape as they head into the off season. So it's just a mentality that really, it honestly bugs me a lot. I mean, if a guy has a, you know, a slight tear and his ACL, of course I don't want him playing, but if the doctors clear him, they clear him and he's just as healthy as everybody else. You know, if the Pelicans are out of the playoff picture, then I guess people's philosophy would be that they would shut literally everybody down. And I guess I don't agree with that. I think that games still matter even when they don't affect the playoffs or a chance for it.
So what if he decides that he's not coming back, or doesn't decide, but he can't come back until April 12th at Houston? You have at Houston, at Minnesota versus San Antonio. And we're in the situation where we're now somehow basically one game back from the Thunder. So they have to lose one more game than we do. That's about as tight as we can get since it's we have the tiebreaker. You basically have to win out and hope they lose a game. And he's ready to come back. We have 3 games left. There could be rust issues. You don't know. Do you play him? Do you say, just how about you just sit out the rest of the season? Or what would you think you would do in that situation?
I mean, yeah, I would play him, and I would know the very real risk of rust possibly causing, you know, in a close game where one possession could make the difference. I could, you know, I understand the real risk of that costing me a game in the playoff hopes, but honestly, I also know that my only chance of even competing with Golden State, and let's be honest, if we're gonna, you know, you and I, our goal for the Pelicans might be to just get to the playoffs, but the coaches and players, that's not gonna be their goal. They're gonna want to get to the playoffs and win. The only chance they would have of even, you know, fielding a competitive series with Golden State would be with Drew Holiday. So the upside is well worth the downside. Oh, well, we don't make the playoffs. You know, life moves on. But I don't know if those guys see the point of making the playoffs only to be demolished by Golden State. So, yeah, if Jrue Holiday could play and you know that you're a much better team with him than without him, yeah, I would personally take that risk. What about you?
I would play him, but I'd keep a really tight leash on his minutes. Like, if I see him just struggling to score, I wouldn't play him long minutes. I would actually make sure I'd sat down with him before the game and say, look, you know, we're going to ease the end of this. You're going to get, like, probably 20 minutes this game, and then I'd try to keep him around there.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, of course, I'm not going to throw him in for...
No, you want to throw him in there for 44 minutes. I know you.
Yeah.
You're completely unreasonable.
No. yeah, I mean, it's going to be interesting. The thing I can't wait to see is what this team... Let me ask you, we've seen a pretty major improvement defensively with the Pelicans. It looks like it kind of coincides partly with when Jrue goes down, but in reality, we also added Kupon, we added Norris Cole, the schedule got a lot easier, Ryan Anderson also went down, who you know, wasn't great defensively this year. Give me your top three reasons, and I mean, the defense is improving substantially. Like, for instance, since the All-Star break, the Pelicans are only giving up 95.7 points per game. Opponents' three-point shooting is under 30%. Overall, you know, opponents' field goal percentage has gone down. Their free throw attempts have gone down. The only thing we're not doing as well is hitting the boards. But really, you know, almost everything else has been much improved. Give me your top three reasons in order or from 3-1 of why you think that this Pelicans defense has been better over these last, I don't know, 25 games or so.
Number one reason is I think Omer Asik understands his teammates significantly better than he did at the beginning of the season. Because if you watch him closely, you will see that he modifies how he defends the pick and roll based on which guard actually has the guy he's working with. If it's Eric Gordon, he ends up shading more towards the guy and moving out a little bit closer. And when it's somebody like Norris Cole, he actually plays back further because I think he expects that player is going to be they're going to blow by Eric Gordon, so he needs to be there faster so that he can contest any mid-range shot or make them be bumped. And if it's Norris Cole, he knows he has a little bit more time. Cole will delay the guy. He can get out to where he needs to be. And I think that is actually my number one reason why this team is getting better defensively. Number two, Quincy Pondexter is better than anything that they had on the perimeter. I don't care. Just pick a player. Like, he's better. And his relief is Dante Cunningham, who, by the way, is also better than anything else they had on the perimeter, other than Jrue Holiday. And Jrue Holiday wasn't guarding wing players. Like, that's been what killed this team all along, is either the water bug quick guards or wing players who knew how to fake three-pointers and drive. So those are my reasons. What you got?
Yeah,
you disagree?
I mean, I think part of it is like you were saying, not just Omer, but everybody else kind of getting to know each other. I mean, I pound the continuity drum all the time, but honestly, these guys are still learning to play together. I think, yeah, obviously the additions on the perimeter helps, and it keeps me thinking, like, if you throw a healthy 100% Jrue Holiday into this mix of Omer getting to know his teammates, you know, and basically playing better on that end, or not even better is not the right word, just, you know, more in concert with his teammates, with Kupon out there being average or above average where we used to have terrible, Norris Cole being out there instead of Austin Rivers or Jimmer. You add Jrue Holiday to that mix. I mean, this Pelicans defense of late is a middle of the pack, 14th, 15th ranked defense. I mean, I don't think it's crazy at all to think this could be a top 8 top 10 defense, and without major changes, just with these guys continuing to get to know each other, continuing to talk, you know, and adding somebody like Holiday in there. And, you know, that's, I don't think it's unreasonable at all to expect, even with very minor to, you know, no changes, that this Pelicans team could be a top 10, both offensive and defensive team next year. You know, which you look at the teams that are doing that this year, you're talking about, you know, some of the top teams in the league. And I don't think that that's something crazy to think about for this team at all with a healthy Jrue Holiday.
Yeah, I think it's definitely within their own possibility. I mean, Ryan Anderson really does kind of hurt the defense in significant ways if he's playing a lot of minutes. So I'm not sure if I'd go as high as top 10 if he's a significant piece of your rotation.
I mean, David Lee is a significant piece of the rotation on a great defensive team the last 2 years.
Yeah, but they have good defenders they have good defenders everywhere. And I mean, as excited as I can be that, like, you know, Coupon and them is an upgrade, none of them are great. They're good. I mean, I would say Jrue can be great at times and Ashiq can be great at times, but yeah, I don't know if I would go that far. But of course, if you put a bunch of good guys together, that ends up making a pretty great defense. So
yeah, let me ask you another question. People get frustrated with a lot of things Monty does. One thing that they get frustrated with is he seems to have a player every year who fans think that he has an irrational love for, that he plays more than he should. I haven't seen that much this year, but do you think that Monty Williams has a Willie Green or a Greg Steenstra on this team? Is there a guy that you think plays more or is given a bigger role than he should have this year, or has Monty ridded himself of that?
Early in the season, I would have said Austin Rivers was that. But I have a hard time getting mad at him when his other option was Jimmer Fredette. I actually would have preferred Jimmer Fredette sometimes to what we were getting from Austin Rivers. But, you know, you've got to live with that. I don't know. I mean, I guess Dante Cunningham might be that right now, but he doesn't really have a great other option. Like, he needs a perimeter defender who can do something, and Babbitt's not that. We've seen what Babbitt can do. He could drill three pointers all day long, but he's got his own limitations, and Monty's trying to fix defense right now. Like, that's the thing we gotta keep going back to, is the team's pretty good offensively. What he's trying to fix is paper over is defensive holes. So, I mean, I would say Dante Cunningham, because there's games where he's getting like 32, 33 minutes, and I just don't see him doing enough to deserve that necessarily. But there aren't great options behind him. And that was, like, true with, like, Willie Green. There wasn't great options behind him.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know what else you could do other than going smaller. But it's really funny because to me, Dante Cunningham, the reason I thought about it was because he seems to fit a lot of the criteria, at least on, statistically, of what people get frustrated by, but, you know, he's a high effort guy, and maybe, like you say, because we don't have any other alternatives, but, you know, if I would have been telling Pelicans fans that coming down the stretch as the team's playing well, you know, Dante Cunningham's playing 28 minutes per game after the All-Star break, shooting 43%, you know, he doesn't provide you with the three-point threat, and he really, I mean, like, if you want to look at some of the two- and three-man teams when you look at different lineups, you know, the commonality of all the ones that are in the minus column per 100 possessions, the one guy who sticks out like a sore thumb is Dante Cunningham, and it's just he really shrinks the space on the floor for almost everybody. He seems to have a green light. Anytime somebody kicks that ball to him, from 18 feet out, he doesn't even hesitate, and he takes it. And like I said, I mean, he's been shooting pretty terrible. over the last 20, 25 games. So, you know, he seems to fit a lot of the things. Like, why is this guy playing so much? But he hustles and he's young, you know, two things that, you know, fans get excited about because, you know, he possibly still has upside. But I don't know. I just – it's really hard for me to imagine, you know, that any – I mean, do you think that there's another playoff team out there, well, at least a real playoff team, not Eastern Conference garbage, but is there another guy on another playoff-caliber team like Cunningham getting 28 minutes a game? I mean, can you think of a guy that big of a part of a rotation for any of the other playoff teams?
No, I'm trying to think of one. No, because I'm just rattling down the Western Conference, and Portland doesn't really have anybody like that anymore. When they did, it was Will Barton, who, of course, blew up in Denver. Clippers play turkey glue sometimes.
Yeah, but 28 minutes?
Yeah, it's not 28 minutes.
I mean, maybe turkey...
Hawes is pretty crappy. I don't think he plays 28 minutes, so...
Yeah, I mean, maybe if you put the collection of their crap together, like Turkaloo and Glenn Davis or whatever. But, yeah, I mean, it's just that kind of leads me into the question of, you know, when this team was winning earlier and when Dante Cunningham was.
Wait. I got it. Oh. Houston with Jason Terry. Going forward, he'll probably get that many minutes.
You really think Jason Terry? I mean, Jason Terry's been pretty decent this year.
I'm trying, man.
So again, about 28 minutes per game after the All-Star break when Ryan Anderson went out. Let's assuming we get him back. Obviously, Anderson's not going to get his full share of minutes, at least not right away. How many minutes? Let's say that Ryan Anderson's going to play 24 minutes. How many of those come at the expense of Dante Cunningham? How many minutes is Dante Cunningham playing a game when Ryan Anderson comes back?
12
minute guy. Okay.
Yeah, I think he's going to be the Quincy Pondexter is going to get the majority of the small forward minutes, but watching the way Monty deals with that wing position is he actually watches in the matchup, and if he feels that Pondexter is being overpowered, he usually sends Dante Cunningham out there pretty quick to try to take on that guy. And so I think he'll get some minutes as the guy to help Pondexter when Pondexter can't necessarily handle one of the bigger small forwards.
All right. Yeah, I think that.
Do you disagree? You think he's just going to be shut out? You think he's not going to get any minutes, or?
No, I think Monty absolutely loves him. I think Monty will find minutes for him even. Yeah, I think he's kind of irrational. And we have these guys every year. It's getting hard for me to figure out why people aren't calling Monty out for Dante as much as they have in the past for Willie Green and Greg Steemsma, because Cunningham started off, you know, fine offensively, but he's been pretty bad lately and, you know, making some bonehead decisions, also turnovers, near turnovers. He gives you a lot of hustle, but I guess I don't get why people don't call out Cunningham and Monty as much as they have for, like, the Willie Greens of the past.
Probably because Dante Cunningham isn't so obvious out there. That's my take, at least. Like, Willie Green, he had the ball in his hands sometimes. Like, he was actually running the offense. So every time you touch the ball, you're kind of like, oh, crap, Willie Green's out there again? Why is he still out there? Is he still out there? And, you know, Dante Cunningham just kind of floats around the perimeter, and every once in a while, like once every 8 minutes, jacks up a long-range two-point shot, and you're like, oh, yeah, Dante's still out there. It's less reminder. And Steemsma was just so god-awful that, you know, it was impossible not to know that he was out there because usually he was doing something bad at every minute of the game.
Yeah, yeah, and I think, I mean, again, the other thing is that there's not somebody viable behind him. I mean, Willie Green had Marcus Thornton, who was loved by,
it's true,
by the masses. So, all right, before we get to the next games, got a couple of questions from Twitter. We got Gavin Lewis, who asks, what do you want AD to work on this summer? He says offensively and defensively. A little harder to work on things specifically defensively, so let's just stick to the offensive side. You get one thing. It's NBA 2K training camp. You could boost his ability in one area offensively. What do you want?
Post moves. Counter post moves. Because right now his post-up game is I catch the ball in the post, I turn and face up, and either I take a one-step lunge towards the basket to get around my guy and amazingly hit a crazy shot, or I just take a jumper. And what I want to see him be able to do is make a move and then counter the other direction. And that's something he never does in the post. That would be my number one thing.
Yeah, I mean, to me, that's clear. I think the other thing Monty said was, he wants him to work on his handle and be able to push the ball up the floor after a rebound, kind of like Blake Griffin does. Anything to get this team playing at a faster pace, I am all for. So I would be good with that as well. Continue working on the ball handling. Kirk Goldsberry put out a pretty interesting piece. And our friend Mason Ginsburg was mentioned in it as a friend of Kirk Goldsberry. I didn't know Mason traveled in those circles, but props to him. But Goldsberry basically said that, you know, he's afraid that if Anthony Davis develops that 3-point shot, his career will follow a similar arc to what Kevin Love's has become or Chris Bosh, and he'll start loving it out there, taking more of them. And that's not what he wants to see from AD. He wants them inside that arc. What are your feelings about Anthony Davis adding a 3-point shot?
I want him to take a 3-point shot, but I want him to follow the Dirk Nowitzki model of the 3-point shot, which is you don't see Dirk posting up like at the elbow and then fading out to the 3-point shot. They run a few very specific plays for him. One is when he's in transition, he catches at the top and drills a 3-pointer, which, you know, if Davis could do that, that's great. But the other play is they do a pick and pop where Dirk flares purposely to the 3-point line. And if the guy stays on him, he then uses that as a fake and then blitzes towards the post to receive a pass instead. And that's what I would love to see Davis do. Like, do the flare to the 3-point line. If he can drill that, great. If the guy's staying with him, use that guy's momentum against him and get inside him towards to the elbow or to the post. And you can do that a lot easier if they actually have to worry about the fact that you can hit a 3-pointer. So I don't want to see him being like, I think at one point Love's like was up to like 6 3-pointers a game. I don't want to see that. I want to see him like trying to take 2 a game maybe. But I would like to see it. I'm not terrified of the 3-point shot. Are you 100% against the 3-point shot?
You were talking to the guy who said that Tyreke Evans should not work on his jumper last offseason. And the reason I said that was because if a guy could do that, I mean, this is any form of basketball. This is pickup all the way to the NBA. If you have the option to shoot from the outside or go bang inside, everybody is going to stay outside and shoot. It's just less wear and tear on your body. You don't have to run as much during the game. My thing is that it's, you know, people always like to think about it like they're video games and, okay, I'll tell Anthony Davis he could shoot the threes, but only a max of 2 per game. Like, you can't control people like that. You know, once a guy starts working on something and he has confidence in it, you know, he's going to want to showcase that, and you know, he's not going to be thinking, well, I've already taken two today, so no more for me. You know, he's going to want to stay outside. And I just, to me, that's just kind of playing with fire of course, I would rather him shoot a couple of threes as opposed to a couple of 20-footers. But I think it's more a mentality thing where I remember hating the Knicks growing up. And when I saw Patrick Ewing take and make his first 18-footer, I was so happy because I knew he would just stay outside the rest of the game. And, you know, the Knicks were far less efficient and, you know, a far less scary team when Ewing was on the outside just shooting jumper after jumper. So I love it in theory, and if this was NBA 2K where I could control Anthony Davis and the team, of course I'd want him to work on his three-point shooting, but I'm always afraid with stuff like that, that once you give the guy that tool, he's not going to want to go and do the stuff inside anymore. And, you know, it scares me a little bit. And it's just something you've seen over and over again with Love and Bosch, and even Ibaka's, you know, was just hanging out around the 3-point line this year. And it's really hard to get a guy to stop doing that when he knows that, you know, it's so much easier for him to just hang out there. So, yeah, it honestly does scare me a little bit.
I think you're crazy. You need to shoot threes.
Yeah. All right. Be careful what you wish for.
All right. So let's talk about the games that are coming up. We kind of gave a little bit of a preview when we were talking about the injuries and, you know, when they might be coming back. But, it, you know, we got a couple easy games here, followed by some not-so-easy games. So at Los Angeles on Wednesday, at Sacramento on Friday, and then back to Portland on a back-to-back in Portland, which is a really nasty place to play. Those are the three games before our next podcast. So, fortunately, you were telling me earlier that it looks like Sacramento may be not having DeMarcus Cousins for this game.
Yeah, I mean, they're seriously considering shutting him down just for tank reasons, which we could all kind of remember. He didn't play tonight against Memphis. They went with my buddy old pal Reggie Evans at center. So it might be a completely different looking team than we got last time. But that being said, Sacramento, as bad as they've been this year, you know, have still been tough at home and have won some games there as of late. So I don't think you could write this off as a guaranteed win, even if Cousins doesn't play.
But what about Los Angeles? Is that a guaranteed win?
I would say it's closer, although, you know, you got Jordan Crawford, you know, kind of starting to play out of his mind a little bit, at least putting up stats. So it's a guy, if you want to talk about one of those.
You mean Clarkson, right?
Clarkson, sorry, Crawford. Jordan Clarkson. So another one of those, you know, guards, waterbug type guys that could give us issues. But man, I mean, looking up that roster, even tonight, you know, they tried to lose to Philly, really had nobody on the court. I mean, do you know who Jabari Brown is?
No.
Yeah, he put up 22 points on 10 shots for them tonight. He's,
I'm sure they appreciated that. Yeah, is he going to hit the waiver wire tomorrow?
He should. I mean, he's somebody. I mean, they're starting Ryan Kelly and Tariq Black as their 4-5. So, you know, they should get swallowed up. I mean, Jordan Hill has been a beast off the bench. But, yeah, LA won tonight. I don't think they want to roll off any winning streaks of late. So I think they're going to be trying to tank this game. But Jordan Clarkson might not let them. It might stay competitive just because of Clarkson, but I think it's a much more guaranteed of a win than you would see against Sacramento.
Yeah, it was a game between Jakar Sampson and Jabari Brown. I'm sure everybody's going to be racing to see those kinds of games.
Yeah, no, that's, I mean, WrestleMania main event type. One right there.
I didn't even know there was a guy in the league called Jakar Sampson. He plays for the 76ers, apparently.
Of course. If you cut his hair, he loses all his basketball powers.
Yes.
So, I mean, these are two games, like we said, we're probably looking at 8-1 or 7-2. You absolutely cannot lose either of those games and hold out any hope for a playoff berth. Those are games that the Pels should absolutely win. So.
Yep, and then Saturday, is this a schedule loss back-to-back, last game on a road trip in Portland? Portland's really nasty to win in. It's, they've got, they're really good at home. Are you thinking they have a chance here or no?
I mean, Portland hasn't been playing great of late. They've won their last three, but they're all, you know, pretty narrow margins against bad teams. Before that, they had lost five in a row. You know, obviously with Wesley Matthews going down, they lost at least some depth, even if you think a Flalo could come in and give you the same stuff. They've lost a little bit of depth there. Aldridge is still playing through the injury. Lillard's actually been pretty cold, especially after the All-Star break. He's not playing like himself. So I don't know. I mean, I don't think the schedule thing is as big of a deal with a team that's fighting for the playoff berth and still obviously very young, but I do think they have a chance of reeling this one off. But, yeah, I mean, Lillard, post-All-Star break, 42% from the field, just 34% from three, where he's been all year, but not playing exceptionally well. Aldridge hurt, shooting guard down. I don't think it's an impossible one to take, and honestly, they owe us one because we should have had this first matchup in Portland.
Yeah, I mean, and also this is one of the few games that we're going to have this last stretch where the other team is also on the second night of a back-to-back because they play in Los Angeles the night before, so they come back home and get to play us. What's interesting about Portland is I always, you know, I've never been a big fan of LaMarcus Aldridge's offensive game. It's never been that efficient. But they've always had, like, a couple guys on their team. Usually it was Batum before, Wes Matthews, who were pretty efficient guys who, you know, averaged, like, that you know, what you want your supreme shooters to be, which is about 1.4 points per shot or 1.3 points per shot. They have one guy on their team who's approaching that kind of efficiency, and that's Myers Leonard, who's all he does is dunk. The entire rest of the team is just not that efficient this year, which surprises me a little bit. Like, Robin Lopez is 1.28, and again, all he does is dunk. Those aren't even efficient numbers for straight dunkers. Like, those guys should be doing better than that. So, and Lillard's only at 1.26, and he was one of the guys who used to be always way well above 1.3 and had a pretty good true shooting percentage. He's having more troubles than I was expecting this year.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely don't think by any means it's an unwinnable game. You know, especially, like I said, we don't know if we have Ryan back by then. We don't know if we have Drew back by then, but it's definitely a team that I think we'll be able to score on. You know, pretty much at will. It's just is Damian Lillard pulling up and shooting the 30-foot threes in our face? You know, does he decide to get hot for the one game against us as usual? I guess that'll be the question.
Yeah, and I look forward to the Anthony Davis Aldridge battles, and it's just because Aldridge has probably the most unblockable jumper in the entire NBA because he's so tall and he shoots the ball directly above his head. And every time they face each other, Davis nails it at least once. And that brings such a smile to my face. I just love the fact that he's such a freak. He can block the unblockable jumper.
He could block the unblockable Jay. You're welcome.
I was about to do that myself, so it was probably good that you did it first, because otherwise our listeners' ears would be bleeding right now.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the rare times the Trailblazers will be on you know, their third game in four nights and a back-to-back against us too. So it's not a huge rest disadvantage, you know, which is pretty rare that, you know, we'll be on a similar rest advantage or disadvantage, whatever, as Portland. So I wouldn't be surprised if we caught them on that night. And
okay. So now here, let's get to the chase. Now that we've talked it up and said, hey, we can win in Portland. We're not that bad, guys. Make your prediction. What's your prediction for this week?
I'm going 3-0.
I'm going 2-1. And I think we're going to lose against one of the teams that we shouldn't lose against.
Which one do you think is more likely?
Sacramento.
Huh. Even if I told you Cousins was definitely out.
Even if you told me that.
You're afraid of Rudy Gay, aren't you?
I'm afraid of Rudy Gay.
Nobody could blame.
He's due. It seems like every year I talk smack and then he comes back and destroys us in one game, which happens to be the one game of the last 30 where he's really good. But I don't know.
Yeah.
Cousins is out. He's going to take 50 shots. What if he scores 52 points off of him?
Yeah, I mean, if I had to pick one, I would pick the Lakers just because of the, you know, the perimeter guys that could randomly get hot and, you know, Clarkson being able to be a guy that we might not be able to defend. I think there's a 20% chance the Lakers could beat us, smaller for Sacramento, but I fully expect to win those two. And I think the Pelicans go into that Saturday matchup with Portland, you know, either with a chance to tie for that 8th seed or get within a game. And I just think they're fired up going into that one. I don't think Portland's playing all that well. And I think they take it. So I'm calling 3-0.
All righty. So you heard it here first. Got anything else to talk about?
That's it.
All right, so thanks, everybody, for listening to In the Know, and we'll be back next Monday night.